Okay, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speaker for today. Dr. Weisbart is the chair of physicians for the National Health Program Missouri chapter. He chairs the Missouri chapter of physicians for a national health program, a 32-year-old nonprofit research and education organization in support of providing an improved form of Medicare to all Americans. He's an assistant professor of clinical medicine at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. He volunteers in a variety of safety net clinics and other nonprofits across the St. Louis area and serves as vice president of Consumer Council of America, Consumers Council of America.
Of Missouri.
Of Missouri. I can read. I promise. He received his medical degree at the University of Illinois in Chicago in 79, completed his family medicine residency and fellowship in family medicine education at Michigan State University in 82, and practiced family medicine at Rush Medical Center in Chicago for 20 years. He served as chief medical officer of Express Scripts from 2003 to 2010. Dr. Weisbart has had several articles published in both national medical journals and local media regarding the healthcare needs of the uninsured. Welcome.
Thanks. I've been looking forward to this for a while, ever since Jill reached out to me. So thank you for having me. I appreciate it. And I learned some things about the Ethical Society that I didn't know. So you guys are pretty cool. We have a lot to talk about. There's a lot of interesting things going on. Things have been changing a lot. And there's stuff that I really want to help y'all understand. But most of it was captured in that song. So I'm going to go home. I'll tear this down. So, I don't know how you found that song. I'm kind of into this stuff, but I've never heard that song. So that was kind of cool. So the run of show is we'll talk about Medicare. Raise your hand if you have Medicare. No, don't do that. So we'll talk about, raise your hand if you don't have insurance. Okay, so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about Medicare and why Medicare is a way forward, is the solution to some of our problems. So we'll explain some things that aren't widely known or recognized or appreciated about Medicare. Then we'll talk about what Medicare for All is. We'll talk about what I think is one of the most pressing things on people's minds, which is, well, okay, how do we pay for that? And then we'll talk about what Medicare for All isn't, because there's an awful lot of confusion in the language right now. So that's kind of what I was planning on talking about. Is that more or less what you were hoping I would talk about? Good. So full disclosure, my organization, Physicians for a National Health Program, we're a nonprofit, nonpartisan, and not going to advocate for any politician or political party, just policies. I am, frankly, an unlikely spokesperson for that, to be honest with you. My background in healthcare starts here. Does anybody recognize this guy? So it literally starts there. 1973, President Richard Nixon signed into law the HMO Act, supposedly to reduce the cost of healthcare, but creating the managed care industry as we know it. And here's the full disclosure part. I thought that was genius. I thought that was brilliant. I was 19, and things were either wonderful or terrible, and I thought this was wonderful. The idea that I thought this would solve was I had seen, even at 19, people, neighbors, family, who had had surgery and things done by doctors that made just like no sense to me. Couldn't understand it, and it dawned on me that maybe it's because of the way doctors can make more money by doing all that stuff, and it disturbed me. And so this model that he signed into law made so much sense. The basic concept of managed care, as I understood it, was, well, don't do that. Instead, pay doctors a certain amount to take care of people, and then if we can keep you healthier, we get to keep some of that and we can make money. And if we screw up and we do unnecessary things and we make you sicker, well, then, you know, it comes out of our pocket to a certain degree. So it aligned the interest. I thought that was a great idea. So I actually stayed in managed care. I went to medical school in part because of that. I went to work in a staff model health maintenance organization. I eventually moved to Express Scripts, as you heard. So I was really pretty deep into this side of the equation for like 39 years or something. I thought it made sense. But little by little, these events kept happening that made me question the wisdom of that. For example, a medical group that I was running, we had Chicago's best rates of vaccinations We vaccinated every kid. We gave every diphtheria, every shot. If you had an opening, we gave you a colonoscopy. You know, we did your pap smear. You know, we literally had the best metrics about that in the region, in the Chicago area. Very proud of it. The thinking being, if we can find colon cancer early, we can treat it for a fraction of what it costs if we neglect it. And then one patient showed up who had hemophilia. I don't know, I'm not going to have you raise your hands if you have hemophilia, but this one guy cost $1 million, literally $1 million a year to get his treatment for this every year. So that $1 million was more expensive than any of the savings from pap smears and all that other stuff. And it made me realize that we should not really be so nice to this guy. I mean, we were pretty nice. You know, we should not answer the phone so quickly when he calls. We should make his appointment take longer. We should, you know, not be as personable to him. We should make him want to switch to some other medical group, because that would save our group more money than all that other stuff we did. We didn't do any of those things to him, of course. But that was the business pressure that we were under, was to avoid sick people and attract healthy people who don't actually need us as much. That bothered me. We didn't do that, but it bothered me that was the business model that we were living under. And I can give you dozens more examples, but to make this more current, here's an ad for an insurance. I guess I shouldn't have put it up that high, sorry. Here's an ad for an insurance company, Everest Prime. It's a current ad, well, 2 months ago, it might still be current, I'm not sure. And doesn't that look great? That's their ad to attract. Who's that going to attract? Mountain climbers, right? Younger, healthier people. It's trying to, you know, if you're a younger, healthier person, you're going to see that and you're going to go, oh, they understand my needs. I want to join that kind of an insurance company. If you're really sick and on all kinds of complicated stuff, you see that and you go, I don't know who those people are, right? So it's designed to attract healthy people, which is fine. That's the business model, I guess. But if you look closely at what they're actually offering, what isn't covered, mountain climbing. Seriously, they don't cover mountain climbing or any injury while practicing mountain climbing. And this is all over the place, right? That's the only slide you have to worry about that with. You can leave it alone. Yeah. You've seen this, right? There's lots of these examples of it. So why are we talking about Medicare? Why would Medicare be a better solution? And I know you all know from the song, lots of things about Medicare, but there are three specific things that I don't think people recognize enough, and a little bit of this is going to require me to introduce you to my family, so I have their permission. So, but what are the three things? First, it puts you in control of your healthcare, unlike Cigna and Humana, you're in control. Secondly, it eliminates an awful lot of the waste, and then lastly, it helps us live longer. So let me unpack this a little bit. First, you get to meet, I guess I didn't need to put it up that high, I could. It's my fault. That's better. So let me introduce you to my... It'll go away? Okay. Let me introduce you to my mother-in-law. Isn't she sweet? So she's going to turn 90 in May. I have her permission to tell you this story. If you tell me a mother-in-law joke, I won't laugh because I won't understand it. I adore her. She's terrific. So that's my mother-in-law. She lives in Florida. Maybe that's why I adore her. I don't know. She lives. Ma has a rare genetic disease in her heart. She has a rare genetic disease in her heart, and it's one of these things that doesn't show up. It's genetic, but it doesn't show up until you're in your late 70s, typically. So my wife may have it. She's too young still at 66 to know, but Ma has this. And it progresses to the point that it will kill you, right? Killed her others in her family. So Ma has this. When she was about 6 years ago, I guess this was, it was the point where she had to do something. And it turns out it's rare. There are only actually three places in the country that focus on treating this. And there are none in Florida. There are none in Florida. So if she had... other than Medicare insurance, she couldn't do what we did. But she has Medicare and she has a supplement, so she could go anywhere in the country. And we brought her to St. Louis, where one of those three places are. And she got literally world-class care, spent about 5 days in the hospital, a few weeks recovering, And this was 6 years ago. She's since had two orthopedic surgeries, and she's doing great. She's doing great. She would not be with us today if she didn't have this done. Or she would have been bankrupt because it would have cost more than her entire life savings. Or we could have paid for it, but that would have been really a lot of money too. But she has Medicare. And Medicare has some problems, as you probably know. Medicare has co-pays and deductibles, and people on Medicare still declare bankruptcy. I don't know if you knew that, but there's still quite a bit of bankruptcy on people on Medicare unless they do something about that. So about a third of seniors do as my mother-in-law, and as I did recently, and they buy a supplement, and that eliminates most of the co-pays and deductibles. But it's still Medicare, so you can still go anywhere in the world, in the country, but now you don't have the co-pays and deductibles. Or they join an Advantage plan, and that also often eliminates co-pays and deductibles, and often without the premium, you have to pay for a supplement. An Advantage plan, though, is, as you heard in the song, is like traditional or commercial insurance, and that Advantage plans no longer let you go to any doctor in the country, no longer let you go to any hospital in the country, but they have their lists. And if my mother-in-law had joined an Advantage plan, she could not have gotten reimbursed for coming to St. Louis. She would have had to go to one of the places in Florida that doesn't really treat this, and she would have had a different outcome potentially. So anyway, she has a supplement. It's great. She has Medicare. She can go anywhere in the country with a supplement. She didn't pay a penny. If you think about hurting her Medicare, you got to deal with that. Trust me, speak from experience, you don't want to deal with that. So that's the first thing, is Medicare puts you in control of your own healthcare decisions, unlike most other insurance companies today. The second thing is it actually stops a lot of the waste that we're going through today. So here's the overhead of the larger insurance companies. Now, my charts that have numbers, as this one does, there will be a footnote at the bottom, which is too small for you to read. But it's there so that if you need me to tell you the source, I can go tell you right now. So they're all public domain, peer-reviewed kinds of good sources. So that's why that's there. This is SEC filings, essentially. So this is the overhead of the larger insurance companies, 15 to 20%. Does anybody want to guess what the overhead for Medicare would be? The government, way less efficient. Government can't do anything right? So what's, I heard of 3, I heard of 5. You're both in the ballpark. It's 2.2. 2.2, and that's not magic. That's because these folks have all those ads on the TV machine, right? These folks don't have the full market, so they can't negotiate the same prices for things that Medicare can. These folks have to pay for call centers and all this underwriting, all this stuff. There's about 500,000 people working here. There's about 5,000 people working here. Now remember, Medicare has the sickest, the oldest of Americans, has tens of millions of us, the most complicated patients to take care of, and they do it with 5,000 employees, and this industry has on the order of 500,000 employees. So it's not magic, they're just way, way more effective and efficient. And then the last thing to think about, and this is my wonkiest chart, but this is the Ethical Society, you guys can handle this. So I bear with it, though, because it's also, I think, my single most important chart. It makes us healthier in ways that I don't think we quite recognize. Here's our ranking compared to 17 other peer nations, Australia, Austria, Canada, Denmark. There's a list here if you really want to know. Here's our ranking of mortality rate. I think of it as remaining life expectancy compared to 17 other nations. Now, before you came in here, you already knew that Americans live 2 or 3 years shorter than people elsewhere in the modern world do, despite spending twice as much. We live 2 or 3 years shorter. So you know we're going to be at the bottom. We're going to be number 17 compared to. But this is by age, right? There's a 32-year-old American compared to remaining life expectancy compared to 32-year-old Irish and Italian. There's a 65-year-old American compared to 65-year-olds elsewhere in the world. So get what this is. It's a comparison of that. So there we are, happily holding up the bottom, despite spending twice as much. You knew that. It's kind of depressing, isn't it? Until, which line is us? We are that line. And this is green is women and red is men. And every other country is high, has a better life expectancy or mortality rate at those ages. Wow. Until, notice the line stops. Turn 65, Isn't that breathtaking? Isn't that breathtaking? So, I mean, it doesn't happen immediately because it takes a little while to overcome, but year by year, country by country, we climb to actually the best in the world. And I submit that that means that we must have many of the world's best doctors and hospitals and nurses and pharmacists and all that. We couldn't do this. The problem is, of course, we don't let everybody in. And to further prove that point, let's look a little bit at some background for blacks and whites. You all know African Americans live 4 to 6 years shorter than do white Americans. You may not have realized that African Americans tend to have a different, overall as a population, different mix of insurance products because of jobs and all the other reasons going into it. So they have a different set of insurance products on average if you control for insurance. So heart attacks, African Americans are 31% more likely to die after a heart attack for a whole host of reasons. If you control for insurance, that excess mortality among blacks falls from 31% to 3%. Doesn't go away, but 90% of the difference in a heart attack, post-heart attack death, disappears. If you look at dialysis, where remember, once you go onto dialysis, you suddenly have Medicare. Everyone in the country on dialysis has Medicare. African Americans live longer than do whites on dialysis. African Americans in the VA live longer than whites do. Again, same insurance. And lastly, once you turn 65, that big difference quickly disappears. So I submit that eliminating the insurance differences not only makes us all live longer, but specifically mitigates an awful lot of the disparities that we... This doesn't eliminate racism by any means, but it eliminates or it mitigates a lot of the differences in the... what I think of as one of the most important things, dying young. So there's that. So why single-payer Medicare? First of all, what is single-payer Medicare for all? It's two basic concepts, improving Medicare and expanding it. Medicare, as I alluded to, is far from perfect. So the first thing that's obvious about it is Medicare has these financial barriers. It has co-pays and deductibles and such. And so for that reason, seniors on Medicare look to find a supplement plan or join an Advantage program because of the, you know, the bankruptcy issues. So what we mean when we say improve Medicare is first fix that. Get rid of the deductibles and the co-pays and that kind of nonsense. Those are just dreadful things that keep people from getting necessary care. So if you did that, then there would be no reason to buy a supplement because the supplements are to get rid of that. So everybody should have that, we think. And then the second thing is the benefit design in Medicare is incomplete. It's good, but it's incomplete. So Medicare doesn't cover dentistry. It doesn't cover eyeglasses and hearing aids and pharmacy necessarily. There's things that Medicare that don't cover. So most Americans look for solutions to that, and some get it, some don't. But we think really nobody should be unable to go to a dentist. You know, we think things like that. And it turns out most Americans agree with that. They're even willing to have a small payroll tax adjustment so that they could have everybody in the country have this. So this is what we mean when we say improve Medicare, these two things. And if you did these two things, not only would you eliminate a need for a supplement, you'd also eliminate any kind of a market for an Advantage plan. People join Advantage plans to get rid of the co-pays, and they join Advantage plans to get, you know, dentistry or some other perks that sometimes these Advantage plans include. So let me dwell on that for just another moment. The reason Advantage plans can do that is because we overpay them. I don't know if you know this little side note. It's kind of a tangent, but I think it's really an important tangent. So Advantage plans, why do we have Advantage plans? These are the commercial insurance, as I said. Medicare then pays Humana, who then manages it like it's private insurance. The reason we have these is because in the 1980s, the private insurance industry came to the federal government and said, are you guys crazy? The government running Medicare? No. We can do it. We're private industry. We can do this way more efficiently than you. And they said, we can put our money where our mouths are. So pay us 5% less for the same patients as they would cost in traditional Medicare. So that was the setup, actually really was the first law that created Medicare Part C, or Advantage plans, was that these private insurance companies were paid 95% of what the same patients would cost in regular Medicare. All right, that's worth trying it. Within about a year, these same companies came back to the federal government and said, you didn't tell us, these folks are sick. Nobody knew how complicated this was. You didn't tell us. And so they actually changed the law and required the federal government to pay them not 5% less than the patients would cost, but 8% more. So they changed the law in the mid-1980s so that these private insurance companies were paid 8% more for the same patients. And as a result, they were able to start doing things that attract healthy people. They were able to offer a gym club membership. Again, who's going to join a plan to get a gym club membership? Not the 95-year-old on a ventilator, the 65-year-old who wants to climb a mountain. You know, so they did this. So they're overpaid. That's why they can do that. That's why. And we think those perks, you know, like the gym club or whatever, we think those perks, improving the benefits, everybody should have that. And if you did these two things, to go back to topic, if you did these two things, there would not be a market for an Advantage plan or a supplement. So that's what we mean when we say improve Medicare, among other things. We mean those two main things. And then expand it. Give it to everybody. Give it to Congress. Give it to President Pelosi. Give it to everybody. Sorry. I thought twice about that line. Sometimes it gets tomatoes thrown at me. Okay. So it's just a joke. So give it to everybody, including Congress, right? The legislators should have the exact same plan as the rest of us. And that's not just to be nice. That's the only way to get rid of the overhead. Those scary 18% bars of overhead, the only way to get down to the 2% level like that is to have everybody in and get rid of all that needless bureaucracy and advertising and all of that stuff. It also is the best way to create a large pool of Americans for whom the government could negotiate prices. You know, our drug prices are roughly double what they are anywhere else in the modern world, despite our having been the people who are tax dollars that paid for the research that those drugs are formed on. So we pay double, and this is the best way to get us closer to world prices, is to put everybody into this and give a pharmacy benefit to everybody in the country. And it creates this risk pool. So single-payer Medicare for all, to summarize it, cover everybody, no copays, no deductibles, comprehensive benefits, and see any doctor, and reduce the nation's costs. Lovely. Doesn't it? Who wants the apple pie now? Right. Yeah. So, but how can we afford this? This is really one of the more important questions. So let's look at that. So you all have heard there's I think two studies that say we can't possibly afford it, but there are 29 studies that say, well, actually, yeah, we can. There have been 29 studies. It seems like every month I have to change the slide. There are now 29 studies that said, of course, there are new costs to this. You know, we're talking about doing stuff. But there are also new savings. And the 29 studies say the new savings are at least as big as the new costs, if not bigger than the new costs. So two that don't, but there are 29 that do. And I won't walk you through just one of these because it's, I think, illustrative. So here's, of course, there would be an increase in new costs, new expenses for the country, because people would do stuff. They would go to the doctor more if there's no copay to go to the doctor. They would go to the dentist. They would get home health. They would get glasses instead of driving blind. They would get hearing aids. They would do stuff we want them to do, but this is one of the highest estimates I've seen of what that would do to cost. So there would be, let's say, at worst case, a 12% increase in cost. Somebody's got to pay the dentist. There would be stuff. But there would be new savings. Now, I said there were two studies that didn't agree with the conclusion that I've drawn. One of the two studies literally stopped right here and said, we can't afford these new costs. What's wrong with you? Well, that's misleading or disingenuous or underinformed, because you have to look. We can still disagree about the strategy and the philosophy and the ethics and whatever we want to do, but we can't say that there's no savings. That's ridiculous to say that there's no savings. So what are the savings? First, of course, it would cost less to administer one system instead of the dozens. You know, the 19% overhead or 18% overhead to the 2% overhead. There's significant savings overall to the system for that. Pharmaceutical pricing, of course, we can negotiate prices of drugs. So this number is assuming a 40% reduction in price for the 15% of what we spend on pharmaceuticals. 40% of 15%, so about a 6% drop. That's the second easiest mistake in studies to look for. The reason I'm dwelling on mistakes in studies is because I promise you somebody right now is working on a third study that's going to say we can't do this economically. And I promise you, I don't know who it is, no inside information here, but I promise you in the summer of 2020, you heard it here first, somebody's going to release a study before the next general election and say, we can't possibly afford this. And so you need to be able to look at the study. And the first thing to look and say is, Did they say anything about savings? If they didn't, they're wrong. And then the second thing, a little more granularity, look and see what they said for drug pricing. See what they said, because the second study that didn't say we could make this work said zero for pharmaceutical pricing. So it's hard to unpack these studies sometimes, but you can look for that. You know, look to see, well, what did they, how much did they say we'll save for that? So that's, so anyway, we think we could save at least that much, and that's not even hitting world pricing. Uniform rates on the delivery side, you know, there's wide variation in what hospitals and charge for the same service. And then lastly, some work on fraud and abuse, and that could probably be a bigger number than 1%, but this is a conservative estimate. So savings bigger than the costs, we get that. How much is this turn out to be? How much money do you need to fund the program? It's important because these savings don't fund the program. These savings are national economics, but they don't actually fund the program. So we have to look at a funding model, and I'm going to show you one. How much money do we need? So in 2017, we spent $3.25 trillion on healthcare as a country. If you gave everybody Medicare for All without any savings, we would expect a 12% increase in utilization and cost. So that's $3.6 trillion we would need to find. But if you look at the savings, so we think that the bogey we need is $2.93 trillion. We think that's the number you need to be able to come up with through a solution. So that's what, $310 billion? And we shut the government down over $5 billion. So $310 billion is a real number. It's a real number. So anyway, how do we come up with $2.93 trillion? This is a model. This is not in a bill. This is not in the House or the Senate. This is just arithmetic. But it's interesting arithmetic. And the reason I'm showing it to you is because we hear things like, well, you have to put like a 90% tax, you know, all this crazy, scary things. I'll show you how if you put a menu together of really modest assumptions on changes to the tax model, you could more than fund the program. Now, I'm going to show you this not because I think this is the right tax model. There are things on what I'm going to show you that I think are actually the wrong tax model. But I'm showing it to you because you can see that the changes in taxes are not, you know, qualitative. You know, they're not profoundly impactful. They're not really material in many ways. So let's look at what you need. First of all, currently, our current tax dollars are $1.9 trillion that we spend. That's, you know, what we pay on our taxes for Medicare and for Medicaid and what the government pays for the military and, you know, what have you. You know, currently, it's about $1.9 trillion. So that's a big chunk of it. Businesses, some people are saying, well, just pull businesses out of this, don't make them pay anything anymore. Well, that would be really a windfall. And I don't think probably anybody thinks that's really the right thing to do for the first step. So businesses under this proposal would continue to pay something towards the premiums or whatever, the tax model for their employees. But you can fund this, give businesses a completely predictable level of premiums from year to year, and reduce what they pay overall by 8%. Again, I'm not saying this is the right number, but I am saying that under this model, if you did that, you would raise $623 billion towards the $2.93 trillion. A sales tax on non-necessities, less than 4%, so not on food, not on clothing, and a few other, you know, obvious necessities, not on that. I'm not a fan of sales taxes, but my point is that a 3.75% sales tax on non-necessities is not what I would want to do, but it's not insane. Not insane. So that much would raise that much. Less than a 0.5%, 0.38% tax on net worth above the first million. Again, I'm not defending or recommending this, but that doesn't look transformative to people who have more than $1 million, if you ask me. And then the last piece, and this is the smallest number, so it could even be taken out of this if you really don't like it, tax long-term capital gains as ordinary income. And that would raise money. Put that together, and you have more than we would need. Again, I'm not proposing any of these, but I am showing you that relatively modest and palatable numbers could get us where we need to go. And at the end of the day, we would, as a country, save, you know, quite a bit of money. Most families would spend, the estimates I've seen are that families that make less than $400,000 or $500,000 a year would spend less on taxes than they do today on premiums and copays and all that. And then they can go to any doctor they wanted to. So the economics are not, the people that I often argue about this with, we don't usually actually argue about the economics because they've seen these arguments and they go elsewhere. They don't have that argument. And indeed, here's what every other country spends per person per year on healthcare. And then here's what we spend on taxes today. Our tax dollars today per person per year are more than almost any other country spends in tax in total dollars for the whole country. And if you add in the private dollars, we're spending roughly twice as much, mostly from tax dollars today. So to me, the best summary of that whole part is from Gerald Friedman. He said, if we can pay for the status quo, you know, we can pay for something that costs less. If we can pay for today, we can pay for something cheaper. So have you heard of the public option idea?
Yes.
Who has not heard of this? Okay. That's about what I get when I ask folks. They don't, or the Medicare buy-in option. This is, I think, perhaps the most important part of what we're going to talk about this morning, because this is not the same strategy. The public option is not the same strategy. And it's important for you to understand this, because a lot of the candidates, actually, on the Democratic side, who are running for Congress or for the president, actually, both, and saying that they're for Medicare for all, they're actually talking about a public option, if you unpack this. And, I mean, I've sat down with, I'm thinking of one in particular who was running for Congress, and up in the main stage, they were constantly saying that they support Medicare for all, that, you know, they've got this family story, you know, they would open and close with, so I'm going to fight for Medicare for all, they would say over and over again. And every time they did, the room would, like, you know, yay, this is the person we want to vote for. So that was pretty cool. So I sat down and talked with them and said, well, you know, let's figure out how we can collaborate on this. And turns out, I'm not making this up, this person said to me that they think that Medicare for all would be unconstitutional. Seriously, he said, I wanted to not use a pronoun. So yeah, he said he thought Medicare for all was probably unconstitutional. That would be the federal government saying to an insurance company, you can't sell this insurance product. Well, that's not constitutional. When do we ever do that? And I countered, well, Ford can't sell Pintos. There's thalidomide, you know, manufacturers can't sell thalidomide. I mean, we do this in public good. We do, if we find a product that's dangerous, we do this, and it's been upheld in courts lots of times. So, but he said he didn't think it was constitutional. Instead, he said, I'm for the public option. When I say I'm for Medicare for all, I'm saying the same thing he said. I'm saying, you know, that I support the public option and that that's the way to get there. And indeed, that's what several of the presidential candidates have said in the last few weeks, that they support Medicare for all, get there through the public option. So let's unpack that. What does that mean? It does sound great. The idea basically is, why wait to age 65? Let's not actually change Medicare, but if you're under age 65 and you're buying your own insurance, why not put Medicare on the market and give it a price and let anybody buy that? Why not give it a price, put a premium dollar on it, and let people just buy Medicare? What's wrong with that? And indeed, let employers offer Medicare. There's like eight of these proposals, and some say, not only should you let Americans buy it, why not tell employers, if you want to switch from offering Cigna to offering Medicare, we'll price that for you too. Why not let employers offer it? It's very attractive, right? The free market folks really like this idea, because it seems like if Medicare is such a great idea, put it on the market, for crying out loud, and let it compete against Cigna, and let the hidden hand of the marketplace determine which one's going to go forward. I submit the hidden hand of the marketplace, and healthcare has one finger on it. But I thought twice about that line too. I don't say that in some it has free market. It appeals to the free market folks, and it appeals to the further right groups. It appeals to many on the left, because it seems like, you know, Medicare for all, it's such a big lift. You know, how are we going to do that? Let's do this. This is a step forward. So it's an easier political lift. The insurance companies won't know that we're really trying to get to Medicare for all, so they won't fight us. That's the assumption, I guess, in this idea, that we'll have less opposition. It's an easier political lift. I'm telling you, the insurance companies know about this stuff. So it sounds great. I'm kind of giving you my bias about it as being a bad idea, but this is what you need to really understand this, because when candidates are running for office and saying they want Medicare for all, and then say they think that the best way to get there is through a public option or let people buy into it, this is their argument. And guess what? I have another side to this equation. The first is Remember that chart I showed you with 18% overhead going down to 2% overhead? That doesn't do that. Wages in our country are relatively flat compared to the rest of the world because of the cost of healthcare. Businesses have a hard time growing because of the cost of healthcare. Americans are having bankruptcy. Americans can't afford their insulin. Americans can't afford, I don't know how many people, a neighbor of mine just last week decided that he couldn't go get his Holter monitor and he's just going to stop taking his blood thinners willy-nilly because his blood thinner was $1,400. The Holter monitor that would show whether or not it was safe to stop the blood thinner was going to cost him $3,000. He hasn't hit his $6,000 deductible yet, so he's made the business decision. He's going to take the small risk of stopping his blood. I mean, this is happening all the time. And this doesn't do anything about that. It doesn't do anything about that. And we all know the cost of healthcare is a really big deal in our country. It doesn't do anything about that. This creates a high risk pool. So there's about, 28 million, is the number, Americans without insurance. Why don't people have insurance today? They don't have insurance because they think it's too expensive. Most of them could go buy one if they wanted to spend that kind of money and had that kind of money, but they don't think it's worth it. So who of the 28 million are going to say, oh, thank God, now there's Medicare, I'm going to buy that? The sickest amongst us, the sickest of the 28 million are the ones who are going to take this option up. So it'll become what's called a high-risk pool. And we've tried that lots of times, and high-risk pools fail because they become increasingly expensive, right? They start here, then the sickest people join them, and so they, oh, God, the premium's got to go higher. It goes here, here. That's a high-risk pool is a very difficult model to sustain. It also will do, so it'll do virtually nothing for the numbers of uninsured. The estimates I've seen are maybe one of the 28 million. Maybe 1 million people would buy it. And it does absolutely nothing for the underinsured, right? The people who, like my neighbor, who's got to make this decision. This wouldn't have any impact on him. And it doesn't improve Medicare. When you hear them talking about how great the public option is, ask them, well, will that add dentistry to Medicare? No, it doesn't. Well, will that add eyeglasses? No, it doesn't. Will that get rid of the copays and deductibles in Medicare? No, it doesn't do that. So this won't get us to where we want to go. But the most important part about it is that we will spend 5 years fighting for this. If we allow our politicians to change the discussion from Medicare for all to a Medicare public option, we're going to spend, easily 5 years fighting to get that to happen. And then once we get that, we'll spend another 5 years, as we have with the ACA, saying, please don't talk to me about healthcare again. Please don't. Let's see how this works. Calm down, Bobcat. So we'll spend 8 to 10 years on this dead end that won't accomplish our goals. And that's what's happening. This is what the insurance industry wants us to do. They are the funders of an awful lot of the apparent grassroots groups that do this. They are the funders of campaign finance for a lot of the legislators, the DCCC, for example, that want to push for this. This is follow the money. This is being funded by the people that don't want universal affordable health care because it's a threat to their business model. So we need to stay on target. This is not actually a new concept. This was introduced in 1962, before Medicare, by these guys and a few others. And it was done in 1960. Remember, Medicare was passed in 1965, and the insurance industry didn't want Medicare. So one of the things they did to fight it was proposing the public option. This is not a new idea. So if you like this kind of discussion and you want to hear more about it, I kind of went quickly over the people that disagree with me, but we're going to have actually a forum discussing this in a couple weeks, in 1 week, a week from today. So I'm going to be arguing what you just heard, maybe a little bit different, it's a little different emphasis, but I'll be making that case. And on the other side are two folks who, I actually don't know Dominic Reeds, but I have a lot of respect for Ken Schechtman, two folks with whom I disagree. They think their position, as I understand it, is that Medicare for All advocacy will fail. And when it fails, all that we will have accomplished, to use Schechtman's words, is we will simply re-elect President Trump, is what this advocacy work will do. I disagree with that. I think that a single bold move is what we need to do. I think this is the right thing. But I disagree, but it's not a crazy point of view. At any rate, we're going to kind of thrash this out, including some time for an open discussion. It'll be on Sunday, a week from today, at 1 o'clock at the Central Reform Congregation. We'll be moderated by the inimitable Cora Faith Walker. I don't know if you know her. You should know her. She's among the smartest people I know. She's an attorney. She's got a master's in public health, and she's a Missouri state representative. And I actually don't know what she thinks about this debate. So she's a pretty good choice for a moderator. She'll spend about 15 minutes talking about issues of healthcare at the State House, which is where she lives these days, and then she'll moderate the discussion that we're going to have. So please join us there. You have a little handout on that. And also, I would love to have you sign up on our email list. So I'll pass these around. Actually, yes, I have four of these. I'll put that back here. So if you're, and you could get that up to the front too, and one back here. So if you have another place where you think that I or one of my friends could speak, you need a speaker, check that box. If you're like in a Rotary Club or a Republican Club or a Democratic Club or some other group, or if your uncle's in some group, check that box, and I'd be glad to come talk or have a friend of mine come talk. So you can also join us. You don't have to be a physician. You can join us at our website. If you can't remember any of this, just look up Show Me Medicare for All, and we pop right up. So there's that. And we have time for a few questions, I think. Yes?
Is there any chance to take a handful of counties or something to test
for that? So the question is there a chance of trying this on a really small level, just in a handful of counties somewhere, maybe a city or two? Is there a chance of doing that? See how that works, and before you test it state for the whole country. And the answer to that, I think, is I don't know. I think at a few counties is probably really tough. At a state level is tough because of laws that limit how much you could actually bring in. You'd have to get waivers and stuff. So it'd be tough to do it at a state level. To take it, and it's been tried at a state level, and it's not been accomplished yet. To go even smaller, you could probably pass the legislation, but if you live in St. Louis County, but you work in St. Louis City, are you eligible or not eligible? If your employer is all over the country, how do you deal with like issues of ERISA? I mean, it becomes really complicated. And if you did it at that small of a level, you wouldn't actually have the negotiating power that you need to accomplish what we want. And how would a couple counties cover you if you travel to Pittsburgh? A Medicare for All program, you've got every hospital and doctor in it. If you do it just in a couple counties, I can imagine doctors saying, well, I'm not going to, that's probably too small to really make it work. It's an interesting idea, but I think it's too small. Yes?
Assuming everything went well, how long would it take for this to get up and running?
So that would be a decision to make. So the ACA took 4 years to get up and running. When Medicare was first passed in 1965, it took 1 year because they didn't have the labor-saving computers that we have. So they did it in 1 year. There are two active bills, one in the House and one in the Senate. The one in the Senate has a four-year transition built into it. So year one, it says drop the age, and then drop the age further, and bring up kids. And it has a thoughtful four-year transition. The bill in the House has a two-year transition. So the longer the transition is, the more chances there are to derail it and to hurt it. The shorter the transition is, the more of an abrupt impact you would have on the economy. So there was a previous bill in the House that said, pass the bill and overnight, 2 years later, ka-ching, put everybody into this program. And frankly, that used to scare the pants off of me because we're going to do something wrong. There's going to be unintended consequences. So I think the bill in the House that says immediately add these people in. After year one, add this extra group of people in. Year two, then add in the rest. And along the way, make these other transitional changes. To me, that two-year time frame is about right. So you could do it abruptly, or you could do it over 10 years. 2 years is about what I think is the right answer, and it's what the current bill in the House with 106, I think, co-sponsors favors. Let's go back there.
Yeah, I think the components on the way.
That's That's a really important point. I don't know if you all were able to hear what he said, but you know, the numbers that I showed you, could you turn the lights back on? Because I don't think we did. That the numbers that I showed you were all pretty straight within the health insurance industry kinds of numbers. And Bill's raising the point that there's other savings too. For example, you wouldn't need workers' comp. You wouldn't need, or much of workers' comp. You wouldn't need much of the medical side of auto insurance. There's a lot of things that would also go away that would be savings for the country. That is not included in this model. I've not seen a solid estimate of that. And part of the reason for that is that you can more than fund the program without even touching that. So that's sort of the response to when people say you're wrong. You know, there's these other huge savings. So I haven't seen it. So I think it'd be worth fleshing it out, but I've not seen anyone do that. Trust me, we could talk quite a bit about that, but I won't.
We'll have to come back next week.
There you go. Yes?
What about the, at one point there was reduced the age to 55?
Yeah. So actually when Medicare was first proposed by Johnson, that was part of the strategy, was that let's start at age 65, then you know in a couple of years we're down to 55, and then age 45. Why not do that? And that is, you know, part of some of these optional approaches, is to sort of do that little by little. So that, again, doesn't do anything to reduce the cost of healthcare for the country. It doesn't do that. It doesn't do any of the other things that we want to accomplish. And it would probably not be able to go all the way to fruition. We could do that. I wouldn't be against doing that, actually. You know, just do it, you know, bring up CHIP from 18 to 25 to 30, you know, bring Medicare from 65 to 55 to 45. You could do that. It doesn't accomplish as much. It would be fought tooth and nail by the insurance industry. And if they're going to fight us tooth and nail, why don't we do what we want? So let me help you with that, because it happens I'm more aligned with your brother. I actually believe in the free market. I had a retail store for 10 years. So let me tell you how I think about that for healthcare. The free market today in healthcare is a business-to-business thing. I, as a physician, am competing against other physicians for the most lucrative insurance contracts I can get. So if I can find an insurance contract that's going to pay me $5 more per visit, I'm going to have to make room for that in my practice. So I'll find the insurance company that pays me the least, and I'll look at how many patients I've got, and I'll probably get rid of them. That's why when you go to a doctor's office and you see that little sign that says, sorry, your doctor is no longer accepting such and such, that's what they mean. It means that we found an insurance company that's going to pay me more for healthcare that has patients who are worth more economically to me than you are. So sorry, Bob, I've known you for 20 years, but you don't pay me enough. You know, I'm going to go to this company. That's what that means. So that's what the free market does today. The free market, and if that means I have to lose 200 patients because I fire them because they're not worth enough money to me, so I'm working retail, man. You know, it's what I got to do. So that's the free market today. The free market today has doctors competing against doctors for an insurance product. That's ridiculous. That's a perversion. That's wrong. Instead, under a Medicare for All solution, that issue would go away. I would be competing against other doctors to attract patients. You know, if I'm giving you the healthcare that you think you need and deserve, you would come back to me, you would tell your friends. If I'm not, you would leave and I would lose the revenue from seeing you. That's a much better use of the free market. This puts me in a free market competition against, it takes the financial barriers out, but it's still me working in a free market to compete against other doctors. I think that's a far better use of the free market. That's how I think about it. Good luck with that. So that's a big deal. There's a few things to think about with that. So of course there would be some jobs, but you know, since Medicare operates with literally 1% of the employees, it wouldn't be a big chunk of them. So there would be some jobs in that. There would be more jobs in the healthcare delivery side of things, because now suddenly we have work that we have to do. It's economically advantageous to have doulas who don't require more than about 12 weeks of training. It's economically advantageous to have a less trained person go to seniors' houses and just check in with them, you know, not medically. There's a lot of stuff that we would want non-clinicians to do. So that's one thing, is there's healthcare work. I don't know how much, but there is that. Businesses today that want to grow but can't because of the cost of healthcare, whenever you do this, you can really realistically expect them to grow. There's companies outside of the U.S. who would be glad to relocate here but can't because of the cost of healthcare. So there's that stuff, there's certainly jobs. The bills, both in the House and the Senate, talk about a reserve fund for income protection for up to about $100,000 a year for a few years if your job is disrupted. But there's more things to think about. The other thing to think about is that the insurance companies are not really spending most of their time on insurance. They're spending most of their time on data processing and call centers and other stuff that's not actually insuring. And they have in the past transitioned out of healthcare. Prudential used to be a healthcare company. It isn't any longer. And they didn't have massive layoffs when they did that. So the insurance companies find a market that do. But I think, to me, the more compelling argument about their context is the context. We're talking about a few hundred thousand people for whom we have lots of mitigation ideas. But how many people changed jobs already? Over the last 20 years, every year, 20 to 30 million Americans are fired. For the last 20 years, every year, another 20 to 30 million Americans quit. So for the last 20 years, and probably for the next 20 years, roughly 50 or 60 million Americans change jobs every year. So that's a long C. And then we're talking about 1 year, one time, with mitigation strategies that's like a tiny fraction of a percent of what's already happening pretty rampantly. You know, the idea of preserving an industry that is damaging to the health of our country, that keeps us with the shorter life expectancies, that's costing us the ability to give wages increases, that's really corrosive to the country, to preserve that because we're, you know, too worried about this piece. I'm worried about this piece too, but there are ways to deal with it, and it's so much more important for the country to get past it. Is that what you were asking?
Thank you.
Yes. Right. Well, what do we do with the buggy whip manufacturers? You know, they're going to be really struggling.
Thank you, Dr. Weisbar. Any other questions afterwards? Maybe they can come to you. Okay.